listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Alistair MacLeod with me once again. Thanks for joining me, Alistair.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
Always good to have you. I know it's late your time, and I'm running a little late, so let's jump right into it. Your most recent article that you wrote has to do with where are we now in the credit cycle? And you start out by defining or differentiating between a business cycle and a credit cycle. Could you do that for our listeners?
Yes. Everybody thinks, and particularly central bankers, think that there is a business cycle. In other words, the implication is that the origin of it is in the private sector, something to do with business, something to do with changing, if you like, emotions in the free markets. It's completely wrong. Actually, the business cycle is the symptom of a credit cycle, and the credit cycle is induced by central banks' monetary policy.
Right. And in fact, you make the point that with sound money, if we actually had sound money, there would be no business cycle, right?
Precisely. I mean, look at it this way. If we had sound money, in other words, no expansion of bank credit, but a constant amount of bank credit, constant amount of base money as well, then you would find that the failures and successes in the economy would be random. Of course, you always get failures. Entrepreneurial business is about taking risk, and risk basically means sometimes you get it wrong. But what happens in those circumstances is an entrepreneur who's tied up capital in something that isn't working very, very quickly decides, cut, move on, find a better idea where I'm actually going to get return on capital. That is the condition. It's a sort of random success and failure that you get. No cycle whatsoever when you have sound money. And what central banks do is they bunch everybody into, first of all, they bunch them by offering cheap money, low interest rates, expanding bank credit, encouraging the banks to go and lend. And the result is that people borrow on the wrong terms. And then, of course, price inflation starts to pick up as that money begins to move into the economy and drive up prices. So interest rates have to go up to try and stop the inflation. And if the central bank doesn't raise interest rates, then the market itself will. You'll find that bond yields rise because nobody is prepared to accept a yield which is demonstrably less than the rate of inflation. It just doesn't, price inflation, it doesn't make any sense. So the whole thing gets out of control the moment the central bank starts stimulating the economy by expanding the quantity of money.
Mm-hmm. All right, in your article you talk about four phases in the credit cycle. You have the post-crisis stabilization. I suppose that would have, looking back at the last cycle, that would have been following the 2008-2009 point of period of time when they stabilized the system. Then you have a recovery. Then you have expansion. And then you have crisis. I'm guessing that you would suggest we're in the expansion phase now or at the start of that?
Yes, we are at the start of the expansion phase. I have to say, it's less obvious in America because money supply, and particularly if you look at true money supply, the rate of growth has actually slowed. But if you put that to one side, look at what's going on in the European Union, look at what's going on in China, and look what's going on in Japan. You've got good, strong recovery. Now, what that does is it makes banks think, hold on, we own bonds. Bonds are losing us money. We are missing out on an improving sentiment amongst our business customers. We ought to be competing with other banks in order to get market share, lending to pharmaceutical companies, lending to engineers, and so on and so forth. So you can see that the sort of herd instinct of banks seeking to move out of bonds and into bank lending proper bank lending in the non-financial economy, that's something that is a bit of a herd instinct. And we're seeing this around the world now. I mean, if you look at the reports that are coming from the IMF, for example, and various other bodies like the Bank of International Settlements, they're all upgrading their estimates of the performance of the economy of all the components that they study. And so this is a worldwide phenomenon. And I really do think that it won't be very long before the US banks start expanding their credit as well for exactly the same reasons.
I can identify with that very well with that, Alistair. I was a credit analyst and a bank lending officer myself in the past, and I know that the bankers go through these cycles. So they start to compete, and they look around and they see, oh, Citicorp's doing this, Chase is doing this, Bank of America is doing, and oh, we better get out there and beat those guys to this deal. And then the lending standards become more and more lax as the cycle progresses, as that phase of the cycle progresses, and then you run into trouble again, and then you run into big trouble again, and you start having failures. And of course, as interest rates are rising, they're rising very dramatically, at least in compared to where they've come from now, which really raises the question that I have for you, and I think gets to the heart of what you're trying to address in your essay, and that is, how far can it go? And I know you had a chart in there that showed the federal funds rate, and you drew a line down through the peaks of the past cycles, and it looks pitifully low, like I think maybe 2.4% or so on the federal funds rate. And if I see, I think we're somewhere around 1.4 or 1.5 now, something like that, federal funds rate in the U.S. So is that what you're suggesting? We don't have very far to go this cycle, because every cycle is, well, you explained that in the article as well. The Federal Reserve, the central banks never allow a clearing out. They never allow a return to equilibrium. One cycle is piled on top of another without the previous one ever being completely corrected, right?
That is correct. And the reason that the peaks, if you like, which trigger the crisis, are getting lower and lower is because the symptom of the economy, in this case we're looking at the United States, which drives it lower, basically is the accumulation of debt. Mm-hmm. The debt gets larger and larger every cycle because it doesn't clear out. Yeah. And as you rightly say, I mean, if you just draw, it's mechanical, you just draw that dotted line, it rather suggests that when we get to something around about 2.5%, then, we could be running into dangerous territory again. I mean, that's ridiculously low, 2.5%, for goodness sake. And what's the rate of inflation in the United States at the moment? I'm sorry, I don't believe the official figures, the true rate is far higher. And I'll give you an instance as to why the inflation figures are just complete rubbish. If you bought a motor car, let's say, in 1997, I understand the average cost was $19,214. The average price of a new car last year was $33,560. Now, because of hedonics, in other words, the adjustments for the improvements that you get in a product, the government's inflation figures tell us that that's a 0% increase.
Right. They give all kinds of,
I just take that as an example of how distorted and how economical with truth government inflation statistics are. It's not the only statistic which is economical with the truth, if I can put it that way. So, I mean, anyone who relies on government statistics to guide themselves, I think, is actually likely to come a cropper. And that's why the one thing that you can look at is you can look at the flows of money. And that's why I think when you see money starting to leave the financial side of the economy and moving into the non-financial side of the economy, you can say that this is really evidence that we are moving into the expansion phase. So there is only that phase before we have the crisis itself. So the next question I guess you would ask is, how long is it going to be before the crisis happens?
That's harder to answer, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I think you can sort of get ideas as to how long it's likely to be. I mean, given that the whole world has been expanding the quantity of money very, very rapidly, and even though it has slowed a bit in the United States, if you look at the European Union, for example, they still have negative deposit rates of the ECB. The ECB is still doing 30 billion euros of QE and looks like extending it through next September. I mean, this is, at this stage of the cycle, this is completely crazy. The ECB is sort of looking at the exchange rate, which goes up and up and up and up, really, because the Eurozone, led by Germany in particular, has a trade surplus, and sort of thinks that a higher euro basically is going to reduce the potential for inflation to hit the ECB's figure of 2%. So, I mean, you know, they're following a mandate blindly, rather like a mouse going into a mouse trap. It's a very dangerous situation. So I think the point in terms of the timing is that central bankers are still gung-ho, behaving as if their economies were well under capacity in terms of their potential. And so, you know, with everybody doing the same thing, what happens is that you get all this money going into the real economy, the non-financial economy in the Eurozone, in China, in Britain, in Japan, and throughout the whole of Asia, throughout the whole of Europe. And the consequence of that is to just drive up prices more rapidly because they're all doing it together. And based on that thought and the low level at which I think that the low level of interest rates at which the next crisis is going to be triggered, I'm inclined to think that the crisis will be on us probably by the end of this year. And, you know, if it doesn't happen by the end of this year, it will be maybe first quarter of 2019.
Yeah, you point out in your article, actually, the synchronization of the cycle now with the G20, with all these central bankers pretty much playing ball together. In the old days, we had some offsetting. You would have, you know, some parts of the world were strong and others were weak, and it was sort of offset. But this pretends for a more pronounced cycle, more pronounced downturn, I would suggest. I mean, last time, I think China grew quite a bit, you know, whatever means they use to grow in China. It's a statist economy for sure. But nonetheless, the demands for the Chinese economy for raw materials and so forth and so on helped. Is it your sense that maybe the whole world is more synchronized now than it was before 2007 and 8?
Yes, absolutely. Blame the G20. Finance ministers and also central bankers meet at these G20 meetings to synchronize everything. They're succeeding in synchronizing everything, but what they're doing is they're betting that they're right, and they're going to have control over the whole situation by working together. I would say that anyone who understands, going back to that original point about what happens when you have sound money and you get a randomized process of those cycles, actually what they're doing is they're making the cycles even more violent.
Yes. More and more pronounced. Well, if so, the central bankers, though, are believing the government's inflation numbers. So they will, you know, they will see no reason to, I mean, but right now they're trying to normalize the Fed, and I guess other central banks may be getting around to it too, to normalize their balance sheet is a terminology they use, means to get rid of their borrowings or to their treasury holdings. And so David Stockman, who I interviewed last Friday, was talking about how he believes we're in for at least 4 rate hikes this year. He suggests that, in fact, and then he looks at the fact that the next fiscal year, even the optimistic views of the government is that we'll be running a $1.2 trillion deficit. And then on top of that, the central bank's scheduled to take away $600 billion. So, you know, supply and demand suggest interest rates are going to have to go a heck of a lot higher than they are now in order for the treasuries to be funded. And then at what stance, though, at what time do the central bankers give in their normalization policy and have to go back to printing money like mad again?
Well, they have a huge, great problem on this one, and that is they just don't want this to happen. The worst thing that can happen to a central bank is economic recovery, I'm afraid, because before that happens, they can sort of continue as normal. There's no way that price inflation picks up because all the money is bottled up in the financial sector. But no, I think the quotes that you just gave me of David Stockman's, I think I would agree with wholeheartedly, and I would even add to it. And that is that the years of a bullish dollar has meant that foreign-owned portfolios have a very high dollar content in them.
Yeah.
The last figure that was recorded by the U.S. Treasury was around about $17.39 trillion, the highest it has ever been. There's no doubt that from the previous figure, which was 2015, middle of 2015, this growth was losing momentum. Now, just imagine what happens as the dollar declines. All those portfolio holdings are going to be at risk, and they are likely to turn sellers. Not only that, but we know that China has enormous infrastructure plans for the whole of Asia. That is going to require huge amounts of capital. Where's that capital going to come from? I suggest that some of it will come from the dollar holdings in these international portfolios. So adding to what you were saying, you have got foreign sellers of dollars, foreign sellers of U.S. treasuries. You have got the increase in the budget deficit, meaning that the issuance is going to increase to, and I think David Stockman's figured $1.2 trillion. I would not disagree with that. I think it's quite likely. And in the middle of this, you have got the Fed saying, well, we want to reduce our balance sheet, which basically means running off holdings. And
okay, Alistair, we're going to have to leave it go at that now. We got a weak dollar ahead of us now. We're out of time, basically, but we've got a weak dollar ahead of us. Should be bullish for gold, I would guess. People ought to be exchanging their dollars for gold. I'm sure you agree with that.
Precisely.
All right. Well, folks, unfortunately, we're out of time. Alistair would have so much more to tell us. We'll have to have him back again sometime in the near future, but that is all the time we have for this week. Next week, Dan Oliver will be with us. Michael Oliver will be as well. And I'm not sure if we've got another guest. That's what I know we have at this point in time. So until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.